We have Denmark on the line. Can you hear them?
I think I can hear something.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Denmark.
I can hear you something. You're there. I'm here.
Yeah, so we're ready now.
Okay, well, we just we're approaching the completion of a current phase of research going on in the basement. This is on the subject of Gauss. And we're in the transition to starting up the next phase of the science work, which is the Riemann project, my Riemann project. This is a good time. We're in the same time, we're reorganizing the youth organization a bit here. It's not just my reorganization. It's a package of various things that are being put together, developed by various people. For example, we're integrating the entire basement-type operation and bring it also closer to the political operations in some respects. First of all, we're integrating the entire U.S. organization, particularly the youth organization, which has its own channels on all the science work. The science work coordinates its effects with other work. For example, we did a project before on the 1923 Berlin Germany hyperinflationary program, which you're familiar with, or the firewall program. We're now in the process of doing another one on the 1932 U.S. presidential nomination and election, Franklin Roosevelt's election, and that is being pulled together. Now, it will take a few more weeks to get it in shape, but it's being pulled together now. We also are changing the organization of the youth somewhat by a new system, which will make it better integrated, and the scientific work will be better integrated. We also have made it clear to all boomers that what we call youth, which are largely young people between 25 and 35 years of age, who are young adults, the same age as sergeants and captains and whatnot in a military force. And therefore, this is the gut of our organization, is the youth organization, in which the older parts of our organization are simply finding their place in this arrangement. Because the daily fighting, the action, the motion on the streets, and the emotion in society, high-intensity motion, is there. These fellows generally are more active, more hours a day than others are. And so we now have that. We are oriented also, as you are there in Denmark, in Europe generally, on trying to prevent a fascist takeover, the effort to build a Tower of Babel called the Lisbon Treaty. And you know what happened to the old Tower of Babel? We have a good biblical authority on that. This came crumbling down. The only problem is it crumbled on the people who are living inside it. So our objective, of course, is to prevent the Lisbon Treaty Organization from taking over Europe and becoming the great crumbling tower that crushes the people within it, and that sort of thing. So we're doing that. We are at a point where our role in the United States, and a spill-off of that in terms of the U.S. election process now, we're playing a critical part. We are not outsiders to this process. We're very much inside. I personally am involved in what you know from the website, my website, on what I'm doing in terms of crafting a perspective on the presidency itself. And what I have am doing has, of course, some relationship and effect upon the ongoing nomination campaigns, but I'm not focused primarily on the competition among candidates for the nomination, presidential nomination. I'm focusing on a design, a policy design, for the necessary composition of the next presidency of the United States. That is also focused on the fact that we have a worse than incompetent president here now. Man's an idiot. It's a mental case. And he's controlled by Dick Cheney, who is only a thug controlled by London. And Cheney himself is controlled by people like George Shultz, who set up the Bush administration, this Bush administration. And in turn, the whole operation is run from London, is run not from London so much as the capital of the United Kingdom, but London as a financial center of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. That is the system of international financier power, which is traces its present power, its present form of power, from the breakup of the Bretton Woods system and the establishment of the oil spot market. That is, during the period of the early 70s, when Nixon broke down and scrapped the Bretton Woods system, a new system came in to replace the Bretton Woods system. And it was done through the oil spot market, the oil crisis of the early 1970s. By creating the spot market, whose nominal capital is Amsterdam, not London, they use the monopoly control over oil in that kind of market as a way of superseding the United States government and defining the value of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar today is determined by its relationship to the spot market prices. And you see that, of course, in the rising effects of that on the inflation and throughout the world. So my concern is, since we have a presidency of the United States which is utterly incompetent, and we have a Congress whose leadership is presently, that is the top leadership of the two houses of Congress, are dysfunctional. They're totally under the control of fascist bankers like Felix Rohatyn and people like that. They're totally dysfunctional. So therefore, the important thing is to have a notion of who or what the next presidency of the United States is going to be, and to be able to shape U.S. policy under condition of great world crisis and accelerating crisis in such a way that we can get the pressure of that kind of process will begin to take hold and give some new direction to the world economy and some other things, even before the next president of the United States is elected or installed. So that's essentially where we are in the overall picture. There are certain things involved here which are conceptual. First of all, as you know, being inside Europe, a captive of this cage called Europe, which is now being run largely from London or from the international financial crowd, you realize that Europe essentially is ineffective, your continental Europe, on a world basis. Europe has diminishing power, almost none, to influence as from the standpoint of governments of Europe, to influence events on a global scale, or that is the important events. All it could do is do a wrecking job, bring down some of these structures which are essential to Europe. So therefore, the decision of what's going to happen to Europe is going to depend upon large forces which are operating from outside Europe. As long as Europe remains a prisoner of the British system now, under the Lisbon Treaty thing, under the Euro business, under the present government since the establishment of this thing, continental Europe is impotent. That is, west of Belarus and Russia, it's impotent on major issues. Therefore, the impetus for what will happen to the world will be decided outside of that part of Europe. It will be decided in the fate of the United States. It will be decided in the relations with Russia, China, India, and other countries, which are more and more oriented in Asia toward an Asian perspective. For example, Hu Jintao's trip to Japan indicates a Japan orientation toward Asia as such, that his primary interests and loyalties lie with Asia. That means not only relations with China, it means Korea. It also means Russia. It also means a closer relationship and cooperation between India and China. It means Russia's much more involved geopolitically in the configuration of Eurasia, that is the part west of Poland, or east of Poland. So that's where things stand. Now, we're in the middle of this process. As I say, we're much more on the inside. We're not outsiders trying to drop messages inside the presidential campaigns. We are a significant factor in shaping the course of the present primary campaign efforts and related efforts. We are an insider in the situation, not by meeting of membership, though there's some of our members are associated with this, but we're not insider by virtue that we are a functioning element in the shaping of the day-to-day policy of aspects of the major presidential campaigns and other things. So that's where we stand. It's not a bad position. In respect to Europe, the key thing we have before us is the FAO. Now, you've got two things to consider in defining what this FAO conference now means. First of all, the international financial system is dying. It has entered a phase of its death. And you can think of the inflation which has hit the world since the end of July of 2007. That inflation must be looked at as somewhat comparable in certain characteristics to what happened in Germany in 1923. That is, you had a breaking point which defined the beginning of a hyperinflationary process. The hyperinflationary process started slowly, but then it picked up speed and picked up speed and picked up speed. And after July, it was really accelerating. By September of 1923, it was ready to blow. By November, Germany was under, broken, as a result of this hyperinflation. We are now on a global scale. Since the end of July 2007, we are now in that kind of global hyperinflationary spin. Pay no attention to anyone who says it's over, that the crisis is coming to an end. The crisis is reaching the point that it really takes off like a skyrocket. So the system is doomed. Every government that's in the system is facing the same type of doom in some respects that Germany faced over the summer and autumn of 1923. This thing is not going to stop. There's no automatic cure. The system does not work. And for this reason, the financial circles centered on London, which are behind most of the crises and problems of the world today, they're running the world, essentially. They have resistance to them. But at the moment, this London-centered crowd is the world empire. It's running the world, and there are other parts of the world which are resisting the efforts of the empire, which is the British Empire. There is no American Empire. There's a British Empire. So we're in that kind of phase. We're headed toward potential war. We just recently missed an almost certain outbreak of a new warfare in Asia, out in Southwest Asia. For example, there were interventions were made to prevent an artificial crisis in Lebanon, orchestrated by London through its BAE operations in Southwest Asia. This was going to detonate a new internal civil war in Lebanon. That Lebanon was to affect immediately not only Syria and Israel, but also to lead to a very early acceleration of a crisis in Iraq, a new crisis, and to an attack on Iran. And from there on, beyond. So we were about to head to a new escalation of global warfare. That is direct warfare in that region of Asia and with its implications hitting the world at large. Fortunately, things happened in Lebanon, which at least for the moment have postponed the use of Lebanon as a trigger. The key factor here is the case of the Lebanese army, which is the real government, if there is one, in Lebanon today. And the army is acting as a stabilizing force to coordinate elements in Lebanon, coordinate their cooperation. And it was the cooperation between forces assembled around the army, including Hezbollah itself, which prevented the British operation run through Saudi Arabia from actually succeeding in detonating Lebanon. At the same time, there were negotiations in Iraq, which calmed the situation down there, and therefore have lessened the likelihood of an attack involving Iran. That doesn't mean the problem's over. The British are going to come back with something new, because they're committed to it. They're on an endgame lurch. And that's not going to stop until some people in Britain decide to quit. But the point is, the Fabian Society, as typified by the Guardian, the London, the Guardian, which is the center of fascism. Huh? Remember, fascism, this is H.G. Wells' fascism. And H.G. Wells' fascism was the Fabian Society. And the hardcore of the Fabian Society in Britain is in the Labour Party. And is typified by the Guardian, the real voice of fascism in England at this time. So they're going to keep at it. The Fabian Society is going to use their Fabian methods, the methods of which were used by Cecil Rhodes and his friends. Those methods are still being used. They're going to try to get this warfare going. They're going to play every part of the world to try to crank it up. What they're doing with the U.S. election campaign is part of it. In fact, most of the U.S. election campaign is being run by British intelligence. By British intelligence agencies, like Scarlet. And they're running this operation in the United States. They're almost running the elections, running the election campaigns, together with big money behind them. So the danger still exists. The fact that we escaped an immediate threat of an outbreak of generalized warfare in Southwest Asia is a blessing. But it's not money in the bank. It's not secured. So we have, this is where we stand. We are now at a point where the younger generation, 25 to 35 especially, who are really young adults, these are adults, they're combat age adults, as opposed to older adults who unless they're commanders of something, are not combat age anymore. They are still an essential part of society, like the people on the home front during a wartime period. They're part of society. But their function is no longer that of frontline combat. It is the young people who are young adults and somewhat matured young adults, intellectually and otherwise, between the age of 25 and 35, who define the real fighting leadership to try to save civilization. And our youth movement is the leading expression of that internationally. The other problem we have in this respect is that the baby boomer generation has failed. There are members of the baby boomer generation who will either play a leading part, a contributing part in dealing with this problem, or will play a supporting role of some significance. But as you see in the case of the Democratic Party, the baby boomer generation in the Democratic Party is by and large less than non-functional. It's rotten. It just cannot move. And what we are depending upon in the United States is the relationship between the kind of youth movement that we represent, led by this 18 to 35 grade, typified by our science program, our basement program, and our history projects. Engaged with the lower 80% of family income brackets of normal people. That's the movement. That's us. That's what we're leading. And that's where we stand. I think that there has to be some changes in the sense of European thinking to take into account some of the things I've just said. There's a false impression about what the United States situation is, where people take a one-sided view of this or that issue and don't see the overall picture. The thing to think about the United States is that the United States was founded actually by Nicholas Sarkozy in the sense that he, in a moment of desperation, where the Renaissance itself of that period was in desperation, recognized that the European forces as such, operating within Europe, were incapable of dealing with a worsening crisis which was coming on at that time. And, of course, you have the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, done by really what we call a fascist movement. And this led to a long period of religious warfare from 1492 to 1648. It was off and on, but it was continuing in as a process. Religious warfare, 1648 to 1648, until the Peace of Westphalia. So going into this period, even before 1492, you had in North America, a place which had been opened up for European immigration by Christopher Columbus. And this was not by accident, because Columbus was motivated by his study of the proposal by Nicholas Akuza for precisely that operation. So the United States' significance in the world still today is that when Europe could not function, that is, viably, because it was dominated by an oligarchical culture from the top, that this corruption from the top by the oligarchical culture prevented the European culture, which had progressed, from being the force which would control Europe itself. So people left Europe and went across the ocean, as Kuza had proposed, and as Columbus had specifically adopted Kuza's plan, to where some of the best of Europeans went into North America for the purpose of taking European civilization, its culture, the best of it, to a place at safe distance from the European oligarchy. Now, despite all the other things that have happened, the essential quality in the United States that defines it is not only that we have a truly systematic, orderly form of government, where no European nation west of Russia, Belarus in particular, has really a good form of government. It's a parliamentary system, or something grown out of a parliamentary system. And parliamentary systems are not good for European culture. It's one of the big problems of Europe. So therefore, the United States, with its constitutional system, its economic system constitutionally, which is directly opposite to that prevailing in Europe, it has still today, despite all the efforts by the British and others to corrupt it, has still today, in the core of its people, in its living traditions, a commitment to the idea, the intention of the founding of a new state in North America. We in the United States represent the heart and soul of the European intention. We represent samples of all part of European culture, European populations. We represent the same intention that was intended by Kuza, intended by Christopher Columbus, who followed the plan of Kuza in opening up the Atlantic to emigration and to colonization. And therefore, we're still an important determining force in world history. Without us, there would be no recovery from the greatest collapse, financial collapse and chaos, which Europe and Asia have ever known. We are essential. And on the one hand, I have to save the United States, because it has this potential that no other part of the world has. At the same time, we must use the potential of the United States to organize the rescue of Asia and Africa. That's our function. It's a hot situation. And you're going to see that our influence is more and more significant. How our influence rises or falls or ebbs is going to determine the history of the planet as a whole in every part. And that's what the youth movement, our youth movement in the United States, is doing. And that's what the extension of our youth operation means as it plays back into Europe. So that's where we are. So back to you.
Hayden?
Yes?
How long time do you have today?
Oh, I have a little time. Go ahead.
Okay. Questions?
I don't have excessive time, but I have time.
Okay. Well, hello, Lynn. This is Hans Frederik.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to know a little about this parliamentary and constitutional system, because I actually never understood why the parliamentary system was so bad compared to the constitutional, and I want to understand this because I think it's crucial to understand why U.S. is so important in this matter.
Well, the constitutional system, the parliamentary system, is a relic of feudalism. It's a reformed relic of feudalism. That's its history. The center of this reform, of course, the British never succeeded. There was an effort in England to make such a reform, and this was done during the period of Queen Anne. There were inclinations in that direction before then, and later, as in the 18th century. But the establishment of the British Empire, or better called the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, a financier-controlled system, essentially defeated that. And so what Europe has had is reforms, as typified by what came out of the reaction to the French Revolution, of a parliamentary system which is sitting within the controlling mechanism of still an old oligarchical system. For example, the key to understanding how this functions even today is you look at the idea of central banking. The U.S. constitutional system does not allow central banking. Central banking would be a violation of the U.S. Constitution. But central banking is the characteristic of European cultures, and it's the key to understanding how the European parliamentary system still suffocates the people of Europe. First of all, the simplest thing is that you often find that whenever there's a crisis of policy in which within the parliamentary system there is a revolt against the current trend in policy in various nations in Europe, what happens is you have a parliamentary crisis which is orchestrated by forces there to orchestrate it. And there's a conflict between the non-parliamentary aspect of the governments, or that, which of course is the state system in part, the state institutions, and then also special oligarchical interests very closely tied to the financier interest. Even though they may not be financiers themselves, the European oligarchy is a financier oligarchy. It's a bourgeois oligarchy, even though there are kings and princes and counts and no counts and whatnot in it. So thus, what happened, as you've seen recently, take the case of how the present Germany government came into existence. You had a Schröder government. Well, Schröder was not Merkel. He had become a significant and positive figure. But he reached a point that his ability to govern as chancellor was in jeopardy. So under those conditions, he prompted a new election, which he lost. Merkel is now sitting on top of a non-functional government. It's not capable of doing anything good. Germany is being self-destroyed under this present government, almost as badly as the United States is being destroyed under the present Bush administration and the present past 2 years of in the House of Representatives and the Senate. So, but in Europe, this is typical, that the parliamentary system does not work because it is not representative when it comes into a collision with the special interests of the oligarchy. The power of the oligarchy is centered not in, even though the British Empire is the characteristic feature of this problem in Europe, the British Empire is not is not the controlling factor. The British Empire is a product of the takeover of what became the United Kingdom by a financier group, a Venetian interest of bankers which moved north from the north of the Adriatic and colonized in the maritime areas of Northern Europe, England, the Netherlands, into the Baltic, and so forth. So the real power lies with a financier oligarchy, which is of this type. It's a neo-Venetian type, which has effective control over what amounts to the constitutional features of European government in respect to monetary and financial affairs in particular. The European old oligarchy, well, that is the part with feudal trappings, is essentially assimilated into a role within the process governed by a financier oligarchy. That is the financier oligarchy which can make or break descendants of the influence of descendants of former feudal institutions controls what are called the feudal institutions. For example, the Queen of England is not really the governor of Britain. The British people really do not govern the United Kingdom. She is created, effectively, as a monarch. She is created by the European financier oligarchy centered in the northern coast of the Europe. She works for them. She is the enforcer in the last resort, in terms of government, over them. But the control lies more in the people who control the spot market, the petroleum short-term market, than it does with anything inside the United Kingdom otherwise. In the United States, our system is such that our system is constitutional. In Europe, the fact that constitutions exist, even with many good features, means that these constitutions don't work, because as long as you have a monetary system rather than a constitutional system such as the U.S. Constitution provides, as long as the control of money is in central banking systems which can operate as exceptions to the constitutions of countries, these countries are not sovereign. They are effectively colonies in the last resort, colonies of the financier power there. The corruption of the United States has always been chiefly the attempt to impose a free trade system on the United States. The best example of how this worked, go back to 1944. Go back to the Bretton Woods Conference. Now, the Europeans who don't understand this believe that the Bretton Woods system was designed by John Maynard Keynes. It was not. The Bretton Woods system in 1944 was designed by Roosevelt in opposition, in principled opposition to the proposal by Keynes in the 1944 sessions of the Bretton Woods Convention in New Hampshire. However, the Roosevelt administration was committed to a decolonized post-war world. That was not simply a just a statement of policy. The Roosevelt administration was organized for that post-war mission. This meant taking down all the colonies in the world and creating a process under which these former colonies would become sovereign nation states under what Roosevelt had proposed as the United Nations organization, as a world nation of sovereign nation states. This was against the British. When Roosevelt died, and Truman, who was a right-wing character, took over the presidency, he worked for the policies of the British government. What the British government did, and the United States government did under Truman, was to defend the recolonization of the Netherlands, of Indochina, and so forth and so on, or to put them through a form of neocolonialism in which the outward trappings of repressive colonialism, like that of the Congo under Belgium, were taken away, but a new kind, a more subtle kind of dictatorship was operating, as in virtually all of Africa today, there is not a single truly independent nation. All of them are controlled by the London market, or the Anglo-Dutch liberal market. So in the United States, we have the same kind of corruption. It's called the free trade corruption, typified by the neocons. But it's against our system. The problem for Europe is that this kind of phenomenon and what it leads to is within the system. It's built into the system. That Europe can be saved, as we demonstrated in the end of World War II, only by action from the United States to encourage Europe to free itself from this control. Or get rid of the European systems as they presently exist. The parliamentary system. You cannot, under a parliamentary system which is operating under so-called free market rules or monetary system rules, such as the rules of John Maynard Keynes. Remember, Keynes essentially was one of the designers of fascism. When he wrote his first edition of his general theory, was published in German in 1938 in Berlin. And in the introduction to that, he specifies that his system would work better in Nazi Germany than it would in England. And he was right. And you're now looking at, with the neocons and these similar right-wing forces who are organized around free trade, you're seeing the logical outcome, the real outcome of what Keynes represents. You also see that Keynes is the prophet Moses, spiritually, of the London Guardian. The London Guardian is a Fabian organization, which is to say it's a fascist organization, but it's also characterized by the Labour Party, at least that part of the Labour Party which represents the H.G. Wells tradition. So this is the problem. So we in the United States represent the typification in our constitutional structure of Europe without oligarchy. The typical American, even to this day, does not instinctively like oligarchy. They despise the oligarchy they see in Europe, which is still there today, which is a financier oligarchy with some traditional family trappings hanging over it as symbols. The typical American despises that kind of government. And it's that despising that form of government which is the best part of the U.S. Constitution and the American population.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I have a question concerning the cyberspace culture, because being inside Europe and all that implies, how do you begin to think of the type of process needed in order to get at solving once you already have been, how do you say, affected by this type of thinking? How do you begin to solve that in the organizing, and well, also, you know, yeah, concerning that?
Yeah, we have to be a good revolutionary, and being a good revolutionary today is defending the best things in European, that is from a European standpoint, is defending the best traditions in Europe at the expense of the ones which are not the best. Typical, for example, is the case of the FEO conference coming up this June. We now have, as a result of the combination of oligarchism, that is the British system, and this comes directly from the British monarchy. The British monarchy right now, in its visible, specific expressions, is a fascist tyranny in the same essential nature as the government of Adolf Hitler. And after all, it's not accidental. It was the British monarchy, or the British system, which put Mussolini into power, and which put Hitler into power. The British put Hitler into power in Germany. They imposed it, with the help of French collaborators. Mussolini was stuck into power in Italy by the British government. Hitler was stuffed into power in Germany by the British government. The British government, especially the Fabian Society, was fascist from the beginning in this period. And that's where the problem is. Now, therefore, the FOA issue, the food issue, where the world is suffering from a projected 50% lack of sufficient food production to meet the requirements of the population. That is, it's not maybe at this moment, but is the projected lapse, projected defect, if this policy is allowed to continue. So therefore, the European struggle for its own freedom from the Lisbon Treaty, which is a fascist arrangement of colonization. Under the Lisbon Treaty, all continental Europe west of Belarus and Russia becomes a colony of the British Empire. The governments have, under this treaty, have no authority to govern. They take orders from the European Treaty Organization government, which runs NATO, which runs the military powers of Europe otherwise, combines them for war against Russia, China, India, and so forth. That's what you're looking at. So, therefore, your resistance to this kind of fascist drive in Europe presently, a fascist drive led from London, is the struggle for freedom, is the struggle for the affirmation of the moral standpoint of European civilization. This requires help. Europe could not survive on its own. Europe is doomed. Europe left to itself is doomed now. Continental Europe has no chance whatsoever on its own. But with doing the right thing itself, and relying upon cooperation with powers beyond Europe, such as Russia, China, India, Japan, and so forth, and what we can muster up from the United States. With that, now then the forces in Europe were saying, don't do this to us. Give us back our culture. Have a chance of winning. So it depends on this interrelationship. Fights like the fight against the Lisbon Treaty, That is the front line of the fight for the very existence of legitimate government in continental Europe right now. Without that fight, resistance to the Lisbon Treaty, there's no future for Europe. Europe is dead unless that fight is won. The key expression of that fight is a worldwide revolt against the British policy on food. This British-led policy on food has caused mass starvation in the world. It's a mass starvation process which has been visibly in process since October of last year. The world food shortage is becoming crucial now. If we do not reverse that policy, you're going to have mass starvation and chaos, including in Europe. The one point of resistance to this is a transformation of the original intention of a scheduled FAO conference in Italy, which was coming in with some more of this nonsense. But under the pressure of the food crisis and a worldwide rising revolt against starvation, this thing may be very useful in the sense it may tend to help to reverse the present policies of Britain and similar countries, which is out to destroy Europe. And if the United States and other countries defeat the British efforts now to get a warfare going, we could win. And winning is a very good idea. And if we're going to win, then the efforts in Europe to deal with some of these things mean that they have implicit outside support. Under those conditions, Europe can win.
Hello, sir. I'm Joseph from Africa.
Yeah.
So, precisely, I come from Guinea, French, ex-French colony.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't speak good English.
You're doing fine so far.
Yeah. So, when I was young, I was in school. They always told us, the Bretton Woods Institution, the creation idea from John Monaskin. Yeah, John Monaskin from England. And now you just say it's from Roosevelt, President Roosevelt.
Yes.
So, when President Roosevelt was starting to when he was in power, how was the objective of FME and IM, IAF, and World Bank? What was the objective?
All right, fine. Roosevelt's intention, remember, Roosevelt's intention was the intention of it's a historic one. Roosevelt was a heir. Remember, one of his ancestors was Isaac Roosevelt, who was a close ally, a banker, who was a close ally of Alexander Hamilton back in the time when Alexander Hamilton was still alive before he'd been killed by a British agent, Aaron Burr. And the United States was always, in its struggle for freedom, always of that commitment, the idea that there should be no colonies on this planet. Now, Roosevelt's intention was very specific. But this is not just something from Franklin Roosevelt. Roosevelt was expressing the same belief as, for example, previous presidents like Abraham Lincoln, most notably, and so forth. This is our constitutional intention. Our intention was there be no more colonies on this planet, or what we call today semi-colonies. Roosevelt's intention was, and he stated it clearly during the course of the war, he told Churchill this was U.S. policy. He said, Winston, when this war is over, there's not going to be any more colonization. We in the United States, with the great power we now represent, with our war machine, are going to convert that war machine to develop places like Africa. And that was one of the Morocco conference, it was Africa that Roosevelt laid this out. And he laid out an infrastructure policy for the development of Africa. In general, using U.S. engineering and other capabilities and assistance to free Africa from this kind of colonization and to establish in Africa, or enable the Africans themselves to establish that kind of government. The U.S. policy was to eliminate all resemblances of colonialism and neocolonialism from the planet, using the economic power that the United States had at the end of the war to bring about this breakup of empire. the Dutch Empire, the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the Belgian Empire, the French Empire. The minute that Roosevelt died, Roosevelt's intention was reversed by Harry Truman. Now, the people behind Truman were the same people or the same family interests which had been behind Mussolini and Adolf Hitler before Roosevelt became president. For various reasons, the British deserted their fascist proteges. Mussolini was a protege of Britain. He's a fascist. The British were fascists. H.G. Wells was an avowed fascist. Keynes was a fascist, an avowed fascist. So at that point, everything was reversed in U.S. policy. And Truman defended the British Empire. And the people who, under Truman, the people who Roosevelt had beaten in the U.S. financial community, who had backed Mussolini, who had backed Hitler, were back in power, like Harriman. For example, it was the firm of Harriman which actually funded the saving of the Nazi Party in late 1932, which allowed Hitler to become dictator in 1933. Harriman. And the thing was done by a Harriman employee who was the grandfather of the present president of the United States, Bush. So we were taking over the fascist element in our society, in our culture, the fascist financier element, which is also the British element or the pro-British element, united to reimpose forms of old colonialism or new forms of colonialism on various parts of the world. And I know it's taught that the Keynesian model was the U.S. model for the Bretton Woods. It is not. That's something that many Europeans believe because they didn't know about this, because they didn't know anything about what had happened until after Hitler was overthrown, really. And therefore, they believe that the turn to Keynes, which was done under British orders by Truman against Roosevelt's intention, is what caused this. I'm a Roosevelt man. We get power, we're going back to that. And you see what's happening in Africa today. All of Africa is targeted for genocide and has been since the middle of the 1970s by an Anglo-American policy. That was the policy of actually coming out of the Nixon administration. That was the policy of the Carter administration. That was the policy under Reagan. That was the policy under George H.W. Bush. That was the policy which President Clinton resisted and was more and more conscience-stricken about, but didn't understand how to fight it. I do. It's the policy under the present U.S. government is genocide against Africa at British orders. What's happening in Zimbabwe, which was the British are most furious about, because Zimbabwe was organized by the resistance of the fighters in Zimbabwe, what was then called Southern Rhodesia, against British tyranny. And the British have never forgiven that. The British are out to crush Zimbabwe. They're also crushing Kenya again. They're out to crush South Africa if they can crush Zimbabwe. And every state in Africa will go into a state of general genocide unless we stop these guys now. That's the issue. It's simply a formality interpretation. This is a living history. It's a living warfare. It's a continuing living warfare. It's a warfare for justice for humanity.
Thank you, sir. It's Joseph again.
Ah, thank you.
You're welcome. So, in Europe, in England, they don't produce coffee.
Yeah.
And they don't produce oil.
Yeah.
And they always fix the price. I don't know why.
I do. I do, and that's what we're up against. I mean, that's an expression of the enemy. Look, the worst part of it is, what is it? Look at the worst part. You have all this talk about this wonderful process of globalization. Now, what's globalization? You take industry, well, take Germany, We're now in Denmark, which is next to Germany. And so Danes know something about Germany. Huh? Germany produced a number of things. Nuclear power, this, that, also the maglev. Germany is not allowed, especially since 1989, Germany is not allowed to introduce any German-created useful technology for the benefit of Germans. Germans were allowed to sell the maglev to China and similar kinds of things. Similar things happen in Italy, but Germany is the most exemplary. You'll see the same kind of things in Sweden. You see the same kind of things, the pressures in Denmark, which has resisted a little bit more than Sweden has. Olof Palme was really a menace in this. He sort of turned the whole thing over to the British. You see it in France, which is being destroyed. It's less destroyed than Germany. You see it in Italy. You see it in the United States. What's happened? The leading industries in Europe, in the United States, for example, have now been exported to so-called developing countries. Now, how does this work? You shut down the productive powers of industry in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in continental Europe generally, and elsewhere, and you ship the production to countries which are called so-called developing countries, China, India, and so forth. But what happens? You now destroy the productive capabilities of the United States. You destroy the productive capabilities of Western Europe, Central Europe. You have a lowering of the real income and living standard of the people of the United States and Western Europe, except for a few super-rich parasites. But what happens? Look at China. Look at other countries which are the so-called countries to which production fled. Well, the price which these countries get for producing the product which the United States and Europe used to produce for itself is so low that in China and in India and in other countries, which are so-called beneficiaries of runaway industries, that the income received from the production of that, those exported goods is not sufficient to maintain the living standard of the lower 80% of the population of the countries which have received the benefit of adopting these industries, as in China or as in India. So therefore, what this is a great swindle. So you're lowering the standard of living of the world through globalization. And this is why in the Bible it is said that God destroyed the Tower of Babel. Because what we're creating in a world is a Tower of Babel. It's called globalization, in which we take and destroy technology where it exists, where it has intellectual support by the population. We move it to some work in countries which do not have that, or did not have that. But we do nothing for the lower 80% of the population of those countries which receive the shift of these industries to them. All China is doing, all these countries are doing, is producing very cheap goods for Europe and the United States, for which Europe and the United States do not really pay. Why does China have all these dollar assets? Because the United States never pays it for what it produces. That's the reason. That's the situation, and we that's what has to be changed.
Lynn, in your recent documents, you've been speaking about how we can change the noosphere through discovering new universal physical principles. But in there, you also talk about that it's not only a question of discovering universal physical principles, but also the present ones, but also new ones that are to be created. Mm-hmm. And what exactly do you mean with that? Do you mean that this is the universe that is going to create new physical principles, or do you also include the possibility that mankind will create new universal physical principles?
Well, see, both. The universe, we're put in the universe to do a job, and therefore mankind has the job of doing this. That's man's reason to exist, is to change the universe by discovering new universal principles and applying them for the first time, in the way the universe could designed them to be applied. The problem is you have a doctrine which is an evil doctrine, which is called the energy policy, the Clausius, Grassmann, etc. policy, the law of entropy, the so-called second law of thermodynamics. Now, the second law of thermodynamics is a big lie. It is not scientifically true. It's scientifically false. And any astronomer can tell you that. Just look up and do these comparison. Look at the Crab Nebula. And realize that the Crab Nebula, which exploded at a finite time and known time, is now supplying Denmark in particular. Ah, when the cosmic ray radiation strikes Denmark, as it does periodically, all that cosmic ray radiation is coming from the Crab Nebula, which is an event which exploded in the universe in finite time. Huh? Isn't that wonderful? And you have just south of Denmark, in an area there, you have this phased array system which measures this from time to time. And you have a smaller one in England, which does, it's inferior, of course, is much inferior to anything you'd find next to Denmark, and which does, but does that job too. So the universe is not, it is not ruled by the so-called second law of dynamics, which is a fraud. The universe is not stagnant. The universe is driven by principles of internal development. Now, we as human beings, with our minds, which can make discoveries of universal physical principle, which most universities are incapable of teaching these days, the idea of those principles, because they don't like Riemannian physics, which does teach those principles. The human race is a very special agent in this. For example, look at the planet Earth. Now, take the standpoint of the measurements by V.I. Vanadsky, the Russian academician, one of the great, great scientific thinkers of the 20th century. And you see, the Earth has a mass, right? Now, when you look at the components of this mass, particularly of the outer shell of the Earth, including the atmosphere, you have things which, from a standpoint of physical chemistry, are specifically products of non-living processes. Then you have a second layer of detritus and so on, things which have been deposited as a result of the action of living processes, and also the continuing activity of living processes. This is called the biosphere. Then you have a still larger rate, a larger rate of growth of a third mass, which are those things which are accumulated on the surface of the Earth and otherwise, which are the creations of the human mind and are not created and do not exist as products of even living processes otherwise. So now you have the planet, our planet Earth is being transformed from what is apparently a primarily an abiotic planet without the products of living processes. The effect of living processes and their development in creating the biosphere, and then the greatest revolution of all, man, whose powers of invention have created the highest of all levels, the noosphere. And that's simply a matter of physical chemistry, as Vanadsky defined it. So you have a universe which is anti-entropic. We have a universe which is characteristic, as the Earth's case proves, it's created by a creative power, which the second law of thermodynamics is a damned lie. And people believe in the second law of thermodynamics, and they try to explain everything. Oh, the second law of thermodynamics. You have Al Gore, who doesn't know how to change his underwear, probably hasn't changed it in years, is talking about science. He doesn't know anything. All he does is stink, and he stinks up the environment. I don't know why. That's why they call him an environmentalist. He stinks so much. He stinks up the environment.
Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
Hello. Here at our cadre school is very fascinating because we have so many people from different countries and with different colors of skin and so forth. And I'm just wondering because there's a tendency to claim that human race comes from Africa, is originated from there. But I don't know. How is it like?
This is a myth because it goes with racism. No, but remember, this planet has been dominated during the past 2 million years, is the best estimate we have now, by various stages of glaciation. And this goes with a certain thing about the planetary migrations of the plates which form the continents. You had, until about 17,000 B.C., most of Northern Europe and North America were covered by very thick layers of ice cubes, with some patches here and there where the ice had melted, because this is over a period of 100,000 to 200,000 years. And what we call civilization today is a result of a change in the climate, which occurred between about 17,000 B.C. to about 2,000 B.C. We define this by the period during which the levels of ocean waters rose by about 400 feet from what they had been during the Ice Age, gradually over a period of about 15,000 years, had gradually reached the level that they are today. Now, in this period when the Ice Age prevailed, northern Africa, which is the Sahara region, was as wet as hell. Not as hot as hell, as wet as hell. As hot as hell came later. So that in this period, when we look at the history of mankind, like looking at another case, take the case of Australia, which is a pretty much cut off area, even geologically, because of the way the plates function. There's a gap between Australia and the country's name, which is why you get all these marsupials there that you don't no longer find in that same degree in other parts of Asia. So you take the people, they used to call these people Aborigines in Australia. And they started to say they were stupid and this and that and backward and so forth. But then we find that in Australia, we had some brilliant scientists come and other achievers, intellectual achievers, coming out of this same population. And the evidence is that all human beings who are not damaged physiologically, biologically, who are not crippled, all human beings have the same intellectual potential as every other human being. In some human beings, this potential is, for various reasons, more developed. But they all have the same. There are no human races. There is only a human race, which has undergone a biological selection in forms. But every human being of any descent on this planet who is not damaged, that is damaged in their basic equipment for being a human being, has exactly the same potential, the same kinds of needs, the same inclinations under normal conditions. You take an African, you bring them into Europe, they're a European. Forget the skin color. Forget all these things. This is interesting because it's a record of something. But don't ever play into this idea that there's anything but one human race, which has every member has exactly the same potentiality as a newborn individual and has exactly the same needs given the conditions to realize them. And the desire to realize those things will come with the conditions to realize them. So, this African thing is a myth. Yes, it's true that during a period in which the population of the Earth in the Northern Hemisphere was limited by the glaciation, which period maybe 200,000 years, and there are many times before that, that during this period you had human beings with different kinds of physiological characteristics, but still human beings, the same kind of intellectual powers, living, and many living in Africa. But this glaciation is not the beginning of humanity. This glaciation is simply something which is a great event in the existence of the human species, because the human species does not have an explained biological origin. That is, the quality that makes the human being a human being does not exist as a quality in any other form of life. The human being is absolutely unique in biology. and all human beings are the same. So if you come from Africa, if you look like an African, in someone's opinion, it doesn't make any difference. What's the point of that? It just may mean somebody oppressed you because they found an easy way to pick you out of a crowd and oppress you. But no, we're all the same. And the sooner we recognize that, the better off we'll all be.
Okay. Hello, Lynn. It's Hans Perler again. I have a question about the media, because I don't fully understand how the media is corrupted to the degree that it is. And it's a great problem, especially on the street, when I talk to people and they ask why they don't know all the stuff that I'm telling them. And I think I really need to ought to be able to answer that question.
Who controls the mass media? What makes it a mass media? The oligarchy controls it. You want to take the U.S. mass media. There's virtually no mass media in the United States which is not controlled by the British oligarchy. We don't have anymore a significant U.S. mass media. We have an exported mass media, which is imposed upon us. We have one. You want to talk about kangaroos? We have a kangaroo that runs the U.S. mass media. He's a product of Churchill operation in World War II, and he controls what used to be the Wall Street Journal. He controls other press. He runs the MySpace crowd, the poor little idiots who are living in subterranean electronic space, absolute babbling idiots. Facebook is a similar kind of thing. All of the major media in the United States are controlled by interests financially centered in Europe, centered in the Anglo-American interests, the same interests which tend to control most of the media inside Europe. So this media don't allow the truth to be told if they can prevent it. Or they may tell some truths because they choose to do so. But they're not presenting you what might be called an objective picture of the reality of events. For example, the great food crisis, which is now hitting the world as a whole, was absolutely clear as an event happening in October of 2007. This is now May 2008. We now have a worldwide eruption, a food crisis, which is going to become much worse. Now we've heard about it. Why did we hear about it back in October of 2007? Through the mass media, because the mass media systemically shut it down. And that's the case. The mass media is not an independent force. It is a means of social control. It is Big Brother. It's 1984. It's George Orwell. It's an Orwellian nightmare. And only to the extent that powerful governments either sponsor or encourage or protect some media from being shut down or allow some media to prosper in a limited way, that you have exceptional channels of information which actually give you some aspect of the truth, even though mostly a partial aspect or from one aspect or one kind of thing. But in general, we are living in a conspiracy of lies. And the best expression, the clearest expression of that conspiracy lies is the international mass media. If it's the mass media, it is the mess media.
Hello, Lynn.
Hello.
Yeah, my name is Steven. I'm from Ghana. I just wanted to find this out from you, what your thoughts are on this. The whole idea of the current way that most education systems are structured, and the way that, especially as like what we have in the youth movement here, and the way that we learn to discover things. I'm just wondering, do you think it's possible to have a system or anything like that where people growing up who have to go to school will be able to get anything that's if there's anything in the current system of education that is useful? Is it possible that you can have a system that incorporates the way we do things here at the youth movement with what is currently existing, and how would that really work, you know, if such a scenario is ever possible?
Well, I tell you, see, as I said earlier in this event today, we are not an also-ran factor inside the United States, nor, because of that, are we an also-ran factor internationally. Since we are a factor, a significant factor, an integral factor in the intellectual life, the political life of the United States, at the highest level. We don't run anything at the highest level. We just run ourselves. But we are an included element operating at the highest level of influence inside the United States. Right? Now, one of the reasons for that we are that, is because what I've done as a forecaster, for example, or a scientist. And what I've done is most significant of late is that I created, or at least provoked, and then stepped in to develop our youth movement program in science. We have just completing a work on the work of Gauss, which has never been treated in this way before. See, Gauss lived under, just to give an example of this, Gauss lived under a condition of suppression of science. And this was especially from the 1790s, the after effects of the French Revolution in particular, which were not good, was a general repression of science. There were exceptions. You had some currents in England which were part of this resistance to this, who were tied to Gauss, for example. But Gauss himself, after that period, was never able to tell the truth about the way he'd made his own discoveries. So what I did is when we started this Gauss project in the United States with a team of six or more, but six core people on the Gauss project, my assignment to them is said, as I told them, I said, you're now going to take on the question of Gauss, which is the predecessor of what and a foundation for understanding what Riemann accomplished, among other things. What you have to do is recognize that Gauss, unlike Kepler, who told you everything about his discoveries, that is, Johannes Kepler, in his books, his actual primary books, writes out everything. If he changes his mind on something, he writes that in there, that he changed his mind, and tells you what he said before, and tells you why he changed. Well, you don't find that in Gauss. Because Gauss is living under a condition of repression. The repression dominated by England at that time, because the British were taking over, and the forces of reaction were taking over by the benefit of the Napoleonic Wars. So Gauss never dared talk about some things publicly. So what he would do, he would make great discoveries, and he made a lot of them. As a matter of fact, without looking at the contributions of Carl Friedrich Gauss, you really don't know, you have a big black hole in the history of science. But at the same time, he never really told you how he made the discovery. He reports the discovery, then he gives you later a plausible explanation for the way he made it. Or he often says, as if I tell you how it could have been made. And he gives you an explanation at that time. Now, this is the big problem with Gauss. That what he says is true, as a scientist. He's a truthful scientist. His explanation is plausible. It's educational. But it's not always true. He leaves things out which are dangerous to mention. Now, you come along with Bernard Riemann at a later point, as in his 1854 habilitation dissertation, and he opens up this dissertation. He tells the whole story, so to speak. The opening pages of that habilitation dissertation is one of the greatest acts of science in all history, because finally the truth was told, as it had been suppressed again and again and again since Aristotle and the sophists generally. So I got these young guys on this. And I tell you, they're nearing the completion. They haven't made their final report yet. But what you're going to see is something that will, it'll just lift your eyelids. Because they have made some genuine discoveries. And we're on the verge of plunging into the Riemann work. Next. Now, in the process of this, as you may have observed by some of the other product of the youth operation, we have also produced some reports which are also unique and important. This work, the influence of the science work, the Kepler and, you know, the Pythagoreans, Plato, Kepler, Leibniz, and so forth, this has had an effect on the youth operation, on our work, and in turn has had a very significant contributing effect on our influence inside U.S. politics. Yeah, this small, you know, I said six people on this one aspect of this project. But this has been a central feature of the entire intellectual life of our organization inside the United States and has spilled over into Europe as well, as some of you know. This is a key part of the capability we have for presently influencing significant aspects of the political process which is occupying the front pages of press today. So we're there. So our situation is not one of isolation. We can influence history. But you don't influence our history by the way most people explain it. You influence history by doing that which is human. By human, that which no animal can do. The problem in society today is most people in the lower 80% of family income brackets, and also others, are suppressed in the way prescribed by the Venetian, by Zeus, the Olympian Zeus, in the Prometheus Bound. The secrets of the way the human mind works to enable man to do what no animal can do, to make an original discovery of a universal physical principle and to apply it. That is what the Olympian Zeus requires that we not have. We have science today where you learn a formula. You say, see this mathematical formula. This is the great discovery. Bunk! No mathematical formula is the great discovery. The great discovery lies in the discovery of a principle. And virtually no textbook today discovers the question of principle. They call a formula a principle. They don't understand what a formula is, as Kepler does and Einstein does. Einstein's conception of the universe is understanding a principle in which he traces in European civilization principally to Kepler. And he's right. Kepler was right. And how much education in Kepler occurred over the intervening centuries? Kepler was suppressed because Kepler told people what the principles were and how he had discovered them and how he had proven them and what he had not proven. And what had to be proven by others, and what the levels of discovery would be, like elliptical functions. Kepler was the one who defined the significance of elliptical functions, later taken on by Gauss and others, and then by Abel with his famous problem, then treated by Riemann with the treatment of abelian functions, who took that and went further with that to the generalized Riemannian conception. Huh? And that's not there. We, by concentrating on this, saying the intellectual powers of the human mind, the individual human mind, as expressed in scientific work, have a corollary in thinking about anything, anything of importance, music, art, everything. It's all correlated. Yes, they're different subjects, but it's the same human mind which creates them. And the most important thing is to understand the human mind as distinct from that of a beast, to recognize that quality, to encourage it, to educate our children, to recognize in themselves the quality which we would call genius. And every child has the potential within them when born, and it's that damaged in some physical way of relevance. They have the ability of genius. And what do? We turn most of these children, we turn most of them into human wreckage, who are deprived of their birthright. The fact that they, unlike any beast, have the potential of genuine creativity. And what we've done is demonstrating that in this way, which makes it more comprehensible by these science projects. We've developed among our youth a capability which I see nowhere else in terms of this kind of standard.
Hi, Lynn, this is Farida.
Hi, young lady.
Hi.
Perennially young lady.
Thanks a lot. This was really exciting. Can you take one more question? Or
I can take one more question. Well, you got an idea?
Yes.
I suspected you might have had one.
Yeah. You know, you're talking about this question of the insight, you know, this when you have insight and you have an intention, which is to do good. And you use the insight to do good and to promote creativity. And on the other side, that you have actually the evil in mind, which can have insight and uses it to create evil or to actually destroy humanity.
Yeah.
Being an evil mind, you know, there's some very, very few people who are that. But you have different degrees of evil, and some people don't even know that they are not acting, maybe. My point is that being really evil, there's some very few people who are evil, but they cannot be creative, can't they? They cannot make discoveries.
Now, some people like H.G. Wells is probably unsalvageable. Bertrand Russell, unsalvageable. These are typical people who are truly evil, and there are a significant number of them in history. But the problem is, if we don't recognize that they're evil, and if we don't understand what evil is, how can you recognize it? And that's where I concentrate. You have to recognize some people are evil. Okay, people agree because they look at acts and consequences which are evil in their effect. But they don't understand this distinction of the evil mind, the evil per se. And H.G. Wells is an example of that, as I referred to that. And I use the H.G. Wells case because it's relevance to today, that H.G. Wells, I mean, the Lisbon Treaty is actually a creation of the ideology of that evil swine, H.G. Wells. It's all there. You look at his basic writings, his Open Conspiracy and other writings. This man is evil. And most of the evil we know today comes from the Fabian Society in Britain, typified by the London Guardian. Huh? That kind of evil. But people don't recognize it as evil. And you look at the whole of history, you can recognize in each period of history some aspect of evil, which comes from some individuals. Like a case of Tiberius, the Emperor Tiberius. This man is purely evil and has an effect. And that's the point, that there are actually people who are properly called satanic. And they're the authors of these ideas, of ignoring reality, of ignoring the rights of humanity, of saying, you know, like the Olympian Zeus of Prometheus Bound, there's the embodiment of evil. The Apollo of the cult of Delphi, evil, pure evil. And people don't understand that. They don't recognize evil in its native form. They see evil in terms of the products as being evil, but they don't understand there's a principle of evil also in the universe. There's also a contrary principle of good, creativity. And that's the way I look at this.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Have fun. As I say, see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.